Seth Winter, our next presenter, has been employed by the New York Public Library since 1987. The following year, he began preserving the sound portion of the Toscanini legacy, a gift from the family of Arturo Toscanini to the library that was made in 1986. To date, all known rehearsals, concerts, and broadcasts in the legacy have been preserved and are available for audition in the Rodgers and Hammerstein Archives of Recorded Sound located in the Performing Arts Library at Lincoln Center. Mr. Winter has also preserved the donated collections of Henry Cowell, Jan Pierce, Vincent Persichetti, Roberta Peters, the Little Orchestra Society conducted by Thomas Sherman, the National Orchestral Society, the Bergen Festival Concerts, and is currently working on the U.B. Blake collection. In 1999, Seth B. Winter Sound Studios was formed, and as its president, Mr. Winter has done remastering work for such organizations and institutions as BMG, Sony, BBC Legends, Pavilion Records, MCAGRP, Crystal Records, Teldec, Universal, Sheffield Labs, the New York Philharmonic, and Minnesota Orchestra. As a result, he received 3 Grammy nominations and 1 Grammy citation for his remastering work. He has also done consulting work and preservation projects for many institutions, including Rutgers University, the UMKC Marr Sound Archive, Harvard University, and the University of Wisconsin. Currently, he is engaged in preservation projects for the Jazz Institute at Rutgers University, the Cy Walter Archives, and the Bach Aria Group collection of live concerts. From 1996 to 2003, Mr. Winter was co-chair of ARSC's technical committee and has been an advisor in the music audio library community concerning conservation preservation practices for almost 20 years. He was one of the co-authors of the CLIR report that was issued several years ago. Please welcome Seth B. Winter.
Thank you, Dennis. If we could have the slideshow, I think we can get rolling here. My program is dedicated to the memory of one of the pioneers of recorded sound, Rene Snepvangers, who died in 1967 at the age of 67. That is the reprint that's available online from the Audio Engineering Society, citing his death and how important he was, as you read on, that he essentially was instrumental in developing the 45 RPM disc at RCA and then was the major cog in getting Columbia to come up with the LP, as opposed to Peter Goldmark, who stole all the ideas and then took credit for it. What you're going to hear today is something that nobody knew about. I wound up with a collection of these discs through somebody who worked at Columbia Masterworks. You all know him, R. Peter Mumvies. When Snepvangers died in 67, his widow tried to donate these discs to the Columbia Archives, and they had no interest in them because they didn't know what to do with them. So she called up Peter, and she said, "Would you like him?" And he said, "Of course, I'll take him. I'll take him home. Don't worry about it. Yeah, I'll hold him. I'll give him a good home." Well, in the summer of 1991, I went out to visit Peter, and he said, "You know something? Take all these. I can't play them. I can't figure out what stylus to play these cockamamie things with." So I immediately got him home and started sorting them, and I asked him, "What did the widow tell you about this?" Essentially, he said this was him tinkering in the early days of the microgroove disc, because these discs are cut microgroove starting in late 1947 and mysteriously stop in 1951. I assume what had happened at that point is in 51, Columbia finally decided to go to tape, and they just abandoned cutting original discs at that point. So he stopped recording. There was no need to anymore, and they pretty much had perfected cutting microgroove cut discs. And as she said, he did it because he was a great music lover, but he was also doing it as an experiment. He was bringing his work at home. And what I'd like to show you is the first selection, which you're going to hear. That's what one of the Snepvanger discs looks like. It's one of the last ones. This is a rather unique thing. Jenny Terrell singing the Shona Millerin from a New Friends of Music concert from January 14th, 1951. Could we have the first track, please?
Welcome to the 10th concert in the current 15th season of the New Friends of Music. These programs of great chamber music performed by leading artists of our time are brought to you each Sunday at 5:30, direct from Town Hall, under the sponsorship of the people. The cost of broadcasting the concerts has been subscribed by those generous WABF listeners who have contributed to the New Friends of Music Broadcast Fund. This season, the New Friends are featuring works by Bach, Haydn, and Schubert. And this evening, the concert is composed entirely of the great song cycle, Die Schöne Müllerin, by Franz Schubert. It will be sung by the mezzo-soprano Jenny Terrell with George Reeves at the piano. Die Schöne Müllerin will be presented in two parts. During the intermission of today's concert, we will have as our radio guest the vice president of Crown Publishers, Mr. Robert Simon. In just a moment, the mezzo-soprano Jenny Terrell and the pianist George Reeves will perform the first part of Schubert's Die Schöne Müllerin. Momentarily, the mezzo-soprano Jenny Terrell will appear on the stage here at Town Hall, and with the pianist George Reeves, will perform the first half of the song cycle, Die Schöne Müllerin, by Franz Schubert. And here she is now.
That's one of the best examples out of the Schneppwanger collection. What makes this collection so unique, he would get things like this. You have to remember, this was a local broadcast. And let me move on to the next selection. Can anyone read what that says on there? Yep. That's the only way I knew what the heck was on this cockamamie disc. The other side had a pressure-sensitive label that had gone acidic. Whatever he had written on there, he couldn't even read it. He had pulled it at one point and then scratched it in grease pencil. This is from her last appearance at Town Hall in a solo recital, which was January 8, 1950. The entire part of the recital she is on is preserved on this disc. And the selection we're going to hear is Bist du bei mir. Funny thing about it is that I had played this for the board of the local Vocal Record Collector Society up in New York, and they were so taken by it, they said, we want this selection for this year and the remaining two Bach arias for next year. And I remember a friend of mine telling me that when he saw the obit for her in 1953, he cried. And I didn't understand why, because I was never really a big Kathleen Ferrier until I heard this. Track 2, please. That little darling took me about 3 hours to fix. At the beginning of the Jenny Terrell, you heard how the announcer's voice was going up and down. Apparently, either the engineers or Snepvogers was riding the gain on this. This took about 3 passes, pulling levels up and down, literally on notes, just to make that sound properly. By the way, that has been issued on our latest VRCS record, and I'm putting a little plug in. I have applications if you want to become a member, and I do have copies with me of that. I pointed to something on here. There's the station that broadcasted WABF, which later became, as we know now, WBAI in New York, a Pacifica station. ABF was formed by Ira Hirschman, who had also started these concerts. Now, we move on to another thing that Snepvanger had a passion for. It was Toscanini and the NBC Symphony. However, I'm not going to play you a Toscanini broadcast. I'm going to play you something I think is even more extraordinary. Ernest Ansermé and the NBC Symphony. This is what one of the earlier labels looked like, which was essentially a high acid paper with glue on it. If you try to clean the disc, I'll show you another one where it had oxidized, essentially the ink just runs right off of it. And half the time the labels have fallen off. What I want to do is play it, because what I felt about it is an incredible reading. It's the very end of the Petrushka suite. And listen to the way he accents the clarinets, but forgive me, you have to overlook the rather rotten embouchure of the horn players that afternoon. Could I have the next track, please? That gives you an idea of what FM sounded like 60 years ago if you had a decent tuner. This is some of his best work. You can hear the dynamic range is quite wide on it, especially when the side drum hits. I just want to point out something of these reviews I'm putting up. These were all from, of course, the New York Times online. And pretty much all these reviews are by Olin Downs, with the exception of the Kathleen Ferrier one. And Gary, I always ask, who is RD again? Who was it?
Ross Parmenter.
Parmenter, RP, yeah. And as you could see how Mr. Downs is waxing about Stravinsky. And in fact, in the rest of the review, he kind of gives a dig back to Toscanini, saying, yeah, there are other conductors out there besides the great Italian master who can get his orchestra to play as well, if not better, without having to go through all the big gestures that he usually did. Now, the next one I'm coming up with is the earliest thing in there. This is a part of a Gershwin piano concerto at Oscar Levent in Dimitri Metropolis from December 14th, 1947. This is a rather interesting broadcast because that week Metropolis had given the American premiere of the Mahler Sixth. And what had happened, I will move forward on this, is that he wanted to do it during the broadcast. They wouldn't allow him to do it over the radio because they felt it was too long and it was also Mahler. In the Mahler box I did for the New York Philharmonic, we reproduced a handwritten letter Metropolis wrote to the CBS executives saying how disappointed he was that he couldn't do it. So instead, he substituted an overture in a Schumann fourth, but then after intermission, Mr. Levant came out and did the concerto. And if you could see what Olin Downs is writing, if look at the length of the original article, most of that, if you see where I bracketed it, at the bottom is where he talks about the Gershwin. Most of it is talking about the performance of the Sixth and what he thought of what an awful piece it was, and he felt that the Gershwin concerto was much better. And then he talked about the fact that when he came out to do the Gershwin concerto, he was so wired up, he was playing it as...
consider one of the jewels in the crown. Stokowski, March 28, 1948. I think this is probably the greatest Russian Easter overture we ever did. There's an interesting artifact. Here is the label for side four at side five. So he flipped literally in the middle of a concert to different labels. And you can see what the acidity had done. I had to remark it so I knew what the heck I had there. The review of this was quite funny. Olin Downs did it. He said, he opened with a Jupiter symphony, nothing great. Fantasia on the theme of Thomas Tallis, which is terrific. Then he decided to do his Wagner synthesis. He says, I couldn't take it. I just left. There's no review for the Russian Easter Overture. Sorry, folks. Well, he left, and that was his loss. Could we have the next track, please? Okay.
Now let's get to the last one very quickly. Charles Munch, New York Philharmonic, January 9th, 49. With Seymour Lipkin, who had just won the Rachmaninoff competition. Never touched this piece after that. Never played Rachmaninoff after this concert. Rhapsody on theme of Paganini. To my knowledge, I don't know of any other live performances with Munch conducting it, and Lipkin was really on that day. Let's have the last track, please. People, namely Dennis Rooney, Al Zipsky, and Dr. Jeffrey Lipton for helping me put this program together. It is quite a legacy, but it's very daunting. Every side is an adventure, trying all sorts of different micro-sized styli from anywhere from half a mil up to 1.5, and even using a standard micro-ridge stylus, sometimes when I have problems playing it. I'm glad I was able to